Transforming Bodies, a judgment-free zone where Trish answers all your burning questions about aesthetics procedures. Find out what and who is the latest and greatest, and gain clarity on what options are out there to leave you feeling good in your body.
Hello, listeners. It's Trish Hammond here from the Transforming Bodies podcast. And today I'm joined by the delightful Dr. Tony Pickhus. And Tony's actually a clinical psychologist. And I actually met her at a conference a few years ago talking about where she was talking about body dysmorphic disorder. I've been dying to get her on this podcast. So today we're going to be chatting with her, and we're just going to chat all things body dysmorphic, weight loss, that sort of thing. So welcome. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks so much, Trish. Very excited to be here chatting with you again.
Oh, me too. I'm so excited to have you here. And this is just a topic of content. I mean, it always has been, but I think now people have become more aware of body dysmorphic disorder. But can you start first off, tell us, like, first of all, how you started to decide to become a clinical psychologist and how, you know, because you've got a PhD as well. So what took you into, you know, the area and why and all that. So can you give us a bit of the background about that?
Of course. So clinical psychology, I think I was always interested in doing something that involved helping people in some capacity. And initially I had planned to actually be a doctor, and I started studying medicine. And while I was in it, I was like, oh, this is great. But I didn't like the idea of only having like such short periods of time with a patient. Like if I was going to be a GP, you'd have 10 minutes and that was about it. Yeah. And I really want to take time to actually get to know people and know their stories and be able to see them over the long term. And so that kind of drew me more to the psychology path, and I decided to swap out of medicine and pursue that instead. And then when I started studying psychology, the body dysmorphic disorder side of things actually just happened by chance. I feel really lucky that it sort of worked out that way. But the supervisor that I was working with for my research, Professor Susan Rossell, is an expert in body dysmorphia. And the more that I spoke to her about it, she suggested some research topics that were looking a bit more at BDD, which is the acronym for it. Mm-hmm. And so I just started reading a bit more and then started seeing patients myself. And then I found it just absolutely fascinating that often I'd be sitting down with people who were beautiful, like very physically attractive in a lot of cases. And they would tell me about all of the things that they hated about themselves. And they'd be pointing out all of their flaws and all of these things that were making them so self-conscious. And I would be looking at them being like, I don't understand what you're seeing. Like, I'm seeing something completely different here.
Yeah.
So that really got me interested in like, okay, what is going on and how can we support these people to love themselves or at least like themselves a little bit more than they do. Mm-hmm. And so that sparked my passion there. And then as soon as you start talking to people who have struggled with body dysmorphia or reading the research, cosmetic surgery always comes up as well. Mm-hmm. Because we know lots of people with BDD, because they feel really self-conscious about a part of themselves that they see as being flawed or problematic, often they turn to cosmetic surgery or plastic surgery as the solution. Mm-hmm. When really the issue is about their perception and what their brain is telling them they look like, rather than what they actually look like from the outside.
Yeah. What a satisfying job as well, though. And I guess because now you're a mum, big congratulations. And so, is it something that's instilled in us like, can we change the way that we, you know, our kids think by just in some sort of way to stop them from having body dysmorphic disorder?
Of course. Like,
is that where it starts, or?
Yeah, I think it's so hard to pin it down to one particular starting point. Mm-hmm. Because certainly, like, you know, our families and the people around us and the way that they talk about their bodies and treat their bodies or other people's bodies makes a difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of us grow up, we might have seen a mum or an aunt or a cousin or a dad criticizing themselves, you know, looking in the mirror, pulling at bits of fat and being like, oh, look at these, you know, thunder thighs or, you know, my love handles. And when we see other people talking about their bodies that way, we begin to learn the message from quite a young age that, hey, this isn't right. We shouldn't have this. Mm-hmm. And so certainly, you know, parents can make a difference to their children's body image just by speaking about bodies in much more neutral ways, or not even necessarily positive ways, but just, you know, this, some people are fat, some people are thin, some people are tall, some people are short, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But it's not just about, I guess, the family environment. We know that obviously the media plays a huge role in social media. So as much as we can try to protect our little ones by the way that we speak about bodies and body image at home, they're obviously susceptible to everything that happens online as well. So that we're kind of fighting against that too.
Yeah, of course. And I think I mentioned to you before, like, so I run a plastic surgery group, and there's about 40, it's women only because it's, showing, their own breasts and, just sharing their own stories and their own bodies. So we've kept it to, we've made it, you've got to be, cis female to be able to join it. And one of the things that comes up all the time is like people say, oh, actually, I saw a post a couple of weeks ago, and the girl said, oh, I don't like my, whatever, something with the chin, what can I get done to fix it? And me, I'll look at her and think, oh my God, she's gorgeous. She doesn't need anything. But it's not about that. It's about how she feels about herself. And like, is there, like, when someone, like, what can you say to someone like that, just as a, as the average layperson? Because of course, you don't want to diminish their feelings towards the way that they're feeling about themselves, but you sort of, I don't know, is there anything that we can do as a normal person?
It's so hard as well because beauty is so subjective. And so even somebody else, if you had to put up a picture of yourself, Trish, and say, what can I do to fix my face or enhance my face? You'd get a million different opinions. You'd get lots of people saying you're perfect just the way you are. You'd get some people saying, make your lips bigger or your nose smaller or all sorts of things. And so I think putting it down to that and saying, look, like it's clear that this individual is worried about their appearance, and you can validate the distress that they're experiencing. I'm so sorry that you're feeling self-conscious right now. I can see that, you're feeling a bit more sensitive about the way that you look. But I'm not sure how helpful it will be for me to point out something. The main thing is for you to feel good in yourself, and that can come from, the way that you look, your physical appearance, and feeling good about that. But that can also come from lots of different areas. And so, the thing, particularly if it's a friend or a family member or someone that you know a little bit more about, emphasizing their non-physical qualities that are beautiful about them as well, or things that you really appreciate, their smile that, lights up the room, or the way that they listen really well when you have a problem, that they're actually a really good listener. I think when we focus not only on the physical, but also on all of these non-physical things that make us special, that make us unique, that can help to build up people's confidence. So sometimes shifting the conversation in that direction can be helpful. I think it's rarely helpful to be telling other people what to fix about their appearance, though, unfortunately. And that's something that I see comes up in these forums and Facebook groups a lot. And it's obviously coming from a really vulnerable place. You're at home, you're feeling really self-critical, you've had a bad day, and maybe you're looking for a bit of reassurance. Maybe you want people to tell you, no, you don't need to fix anything, you're perfect. But either way, we know that that reassurance, whether it's positive, like you're perfect, you don't need to change, or yes, you definitely need bigger lips or a smaller nose, either way, it's not really helpful, unfortunately.
Well, it's really funny you should say that, because I remember when I first went to see someone, she was an injector, a local injector, and I went there, and I remember I was 44 years old, and I just hadn't even kind of stepped into the, the aesthetics. I just, it wasn't kind of, I always wanted to look good, but I wasn't actually looking at anti-aging preventive stuff. It wasn't in my mindset then, and I was 44, and I'm 60 now, so it's like 16 years ago. And I remember walking in and just being around and saying, well, what do you think I need? And I was expecting, you don't need anything, you look fine the way you are. And then she said, well, just frown. And then she's like, smile. She says, oh, we can't have that. And she was like, you need this, this. I was like, holy heck. But once you are exposed to something, you can't unhear it, if that makes any sense. And so that, of course, not that I'm blaming her at all, because I sort of went in there probably, like, what do I need? Like, how good do I look already? And I didn't get that. But having said that, on the complete opposite spectrum, when I've gone to have some plastic surgery procedures, because being a massive weight loss patient, I've found that the plastic surgeon has always said, well, what is it that I can help you with, kind of thing. And then they're listening to me, as opposed to them making suggestions, and then they're kind of guiding you to your outcome. So what you've said resonates 100% with me, but I only relate it to the injectables compared to the surgery. But there are tools, like there are tools these days that can actually help in clinic that practitioners should use. Is that right? Like questionnaires and
Of
can you
course,
tell us a bit about that?
yeah. So there's been lots of changes obviously going on in the whole cosmetic industry over the last couple of years. And one of the things that they're sort of taking an interest in now with these new guidelines from the medical board, which has changed the way surgeons and injectors operate, that we want to protect patient safety. And so what that means is tuning in a bit more to patient mental health or their psychological well-being and seeing if that might be playing a role in why they're wanting that procedure. And if it is, then offering them more support along the way. So body dysmorphic disorder is obviously one condition that we know is strongly associated with reduced satisfaction with cosmetic procedures. So when people have body dysmorphia, even though they think that the surgery is the answer, it unfortunately doesn't usually fix their perception of themselves, and people can be left feeling much worse or regretting that they had the procedure or the surgery done. So part of the new guidelines is that cosmetic practitioners should be screening their patients for body dysmorphic disorder beforehand. And if it's identified, it doesn't mean that the person can't get the procedure or can't get the surgery, but that they should be referred on for a further discussion with a mental health professional before going ahead with anything. And I think that's raised some really interesting questions. Certainly, over the last few months, I've been working very heavily in this space and through ReadyMind as well, which is my business where we do the assessments for patients who want to get cosmetic surgery or a procedure. But we also have screening software for cosmetic practitioners and questionnaires to help them assess their patients. I've heard lots of different things from both patients and practitioners about these new guidelines. And I think one major concern is that people feel like maybe it takes away patient autonomy a little bit, like the right to make decisions about themselves. And I think the way that I see it is that actually we're sort of giving patients back their autonomy, because when you're feeling really vulnerable and you might go in for a consult and, fix me or what can I do? I actually think in that moment, potentially you don't have the autonomy. You're feeling so vulnerable that you're willing to sort of take on any advice or feedback that you're getting from the surgeon or the practitioner, particularly in the wrong hands. And so this is just to slow down the process and say, hey, let's have a bit more of a chat about this. And let's not just talk about your physical appearance, but let's talk about what's going on more broadly and how you're feeling about yourself and how we can support you to feel your best, whether that's through the aesthetic treatment or if there are other options as well. So it's much more holistic and helping people to make a decision with all of that information.
Well, and interesting that you say that because, say, for example, if someone is identified with body dysmorphic order and you think, oh, okay, well, this person shouldn't be having surgery because it's not going to do any good, then, like, not that fixed, but I'll say, can they be fixed? Because what will happen is if they're not going to get that surgery from the person they want, they're going to go overseas or there's someone that's going to do it for them. Do you know what I mean? And then that's adding another layer of danger, to what could happen because then they're going to come back and they might not, I don't know, anything could happen. I guess anything could happen with any surgery anyway, but still, it's sort of like, it's almost like we're giving help, but is that taking it away from them as well?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, ideally, anytime a person's identified with body dysmorphic disorder during this process, they should be offered additional support as well. So whether that's, we can do some therapy, we can do therapy for 10 sessions, 12 sessions, 6 sessions, or even just a few, and then let's reassess about the surgery or the procedure that you're wanting to have so that there's some sort of plan in place that it's not. No, you can never have this procedure because then, of course, if you really want it, if you're sure that that's what you need at that time, you'll go find someone to do it. But I think it's a tricky one. Certainly, there will be people who will go overseas or who will find someone to do the surgery for them. But I think sometimes what we're doing is just planting the seed. That they then go away and they're thinking about it. And there might be the part of them that still really wants that surgery or procedure, but the other part of them that's saying, oh, that surgeon, though, who I really trusted, told me that maybe I shouldn't get it right now. And that might be at the back of their mind. And that might open up an avenue for them to do some other work on themselves, whether it's not at the time of the consult, might happen a few weeks later, a few months, or even years later. I think sort of opened up their thinking about it. Yeah, which I think does make a difference. But also, I think the alternative is not having any safeguards in place, means that in Australia, lots of people with body dysmorphia will get surgeries or procedures that they don't necessarily need and might leave them in a worse position. So hopefully this
I
is
see
the,
that too. Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully it's the lesser of two evils, I think.
Yep. Yep, that's so true. And ultimately the thing is to not like to sort of because people that are like that, because I know that I can be a bit, I mentioned to you before, like I've lost 60 kilos and I look at photos of myself before and I'm unrecognizable to myself, but then by the same token I'll look at myself in the morning, get up and my stomach be, and I'll feel as fat as I ever felt in my life. Like I just cannot see that, you know, I know that I'm a lesser person, but in my mind I'm still that fat person. Like to go, when I go looking in the shops, the first thing I do looking at clothes, I'll always go to the back of the rack because that's what I've done, you know, for the majority of my life. So it's you know, is that ever going to change, or do I just need to accept that I need to stop and think about things before I'll go out and get something done, or yeah,
yeah,
it's kind of like a whole, it's like a, it's so crazy.
It is, absolutely. And I think that's such a common experience that you had as well, that like, even though your external appearance might change, the way that you feel internally can take time to catch up, or perhaps it doesn't just change automatically. You actually have to do the work on that part of yourself to get the changes that you're looking for, and the external change doesn't quite fix the self-consciousness maybe that you're feeling, or that mentality of like, okay, I always go to the back of the rack, that might take a bit of effort to practice and change.
And then I'll put something on and it'll be a, you know, 12, and it'll be like, oh my god, this is too big, and I'll hold the 10 up and I'll think, no way, and I'll put it on, I'm like, oh my god, it's a size freaking 10, like what the heck, you know. And of course that'll keep me happy for a few days. Like it's just, it's so funny how we bring our own happiness to ourselves, you know, like just in that vanity mentality, I guess, or I don't know if that's the right word, but
of course, often what I talk to people about, even like before they've gone ahead and had a procedure or a surgery, is, you know, what would you ideally like to be doing differently or feeling differently? What sort of life would you like to be living in that new body, or with those new breasts? You know, what would your day-to-day look like? And is it possible to start to do some of that even before you've had the surgery? So, you know, it might be commonly, you know, people in bigger bodies often feel self-conscious wearing certain types of clothing. Maybe it's wearing a singlet. They never allow themselves to wear a singlet, and they hope that, you know, after they've lost X amount of weight, they'll be able to wear those singlets. So I would really encourage them to actually start trying to wear that now and get comfortable wearing that now, even in the body that you're in, so that, you know, when your body changes, it doesn't feel like such a big step to do that. You realize like, I can, you know, I can wear these clothes, I can go out to that restaurant or go to that party, regardless of what my body looks like, because there's more to me than just that physical feature. I think that can help people sometimes with the adjustment.
And do you reckon, like, what makes me, like, what makes my brain, or why is my brain different to, say I've got a girlfriend who just doesn't care about it, like she's just happy who she is, how she is, and she doesn't care about anything like that, and she's like one of my best friends and I'm the complete opposite, like what's different about us? Like we're best friends, you know, like, but we're complete opposites.
Yeah, well, you're definitely not alone. We know, like, obviously most women in general, but men as well, and, you know, all genders, it's very common to have things that we don't like about our bodies. So I'm sure even your friend who feels really comfortable, I'm sure there would be things, if she had to nitpick, that she's not quite happy with. So that societal impact plays a big role, like the advertising that we see, media, magazines, how bodies are portrayed. All of us are exposed to that, but not everyone develops an eating disorder or body dysmorphia or has extreme body image concerns. And so sometimes that comes back. Sometimes it's just a genetic thing, you know, potentially it runs in the family, or there's some sort of genetic predisposition. Sometimes it might be about your upbringing or messages that you might have learned about appearance growing up. That can play a role and make one person a bit more susceptible than another. Usually it's a whole combination of factors, and it's sometimes hard for us to pinpoint, oh yes, it was that one thing that meant that you feel more self-conscious than another.
Yeah, well, funny because I do remember from childhood, because I'm a grandmother now, so I've got grandbabies and I've got boys and girls, and I'm like, I try not to say the word fat, or you know, like, or like, I try to kind of keep the personal appearance out of, you know, out of, you know, although having said that, I've got one, they're the one granddaughter and she's a princess, and it's always about, you know, the way she looks, and she likes to pose proper for a photo. It's just who she is, you know what I mean? She's a little dancer and that's who she is, and she's always gonna, you know, want to put makeup on and stuff like that because that's just who she is. But I remember my grandmother saying to me, because I was big as a child, well, I didn't, later on, or after, I don't know, eight or whatever, I was big as a child, and she used to say to me, go on, eat that chocolate there, see how fat you can get. And I'd be like, I will. And I would just, like, you know, just for spite, I'd be like, yeah, I will. And I can remember that vividly, what she used to say to me. And I started saying it to my daughter, and like when she was little, until I thought, oh my God, that is so the wrong thing to say, because we're so conditioned to teach, you know, what, you know, to sort of teach what we've learned. So it's a struggle for me to not say things like that, which sounds really bad, but it just genuinely is. So we have to be careful what we feed our children, hey, as in words.
Yes, totally. And I don't think you're alone with this at all, is that a lot of the time, if we want to develop a healthier relationship with our bodies and help our children do the same, it involves a lot of unlearning first, because these messages are so strong. And, you know, we're in a generation now, I guess, where body positivity and body acceptance is spoken about, and it's becoming more and more prominent. It wasn't like that in the past.
Yeah.
So we all have these sort of intergenerational influences with quite negative messaging about bodies that we have to work on unlearning.
Of course. So,
yeah.
So what would you just say to someone who's sort of like, what would be the first step to someone who's sort of like, oh, I want to have this surgery, but I'm really worried about it, and do I really need it? Or, you know, if someone who's in doubt and doesn't know where to start, and like, what would you suggest that they do first? Like, do you reckon you should go and speak to someone first, or speak to a say if it's surgery, or speak to a surgeon? Or, I mean, generally, like anything I've ever had done, I've been wanting it for years and years and years. It's been, you know, a real, you know, like, I've had massive boobs, and of course they got bigger, and then as I lost weight, they got bigger, longer and longer. So, you know, for me, that was, I'd wanted that for nearly 20 years, maybe more than that, actually, because I hated having big boobs. But yeah. So what would you say to someone? What would be the first step if they're just unsure?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the time people start with their research on the internet, don't they? They'll start Googling things and looking at forums, which can be helpful in one way. Obviously, the internet has a wealth of information.
Yeah.
You can also read a lot of unhelpful stuff on the internet. And once you've been researching for so long, I think people can really convince themselves that this is the procedure that they need before they've even spoken to someone about whether it's really appropriate for them, or, you know, whether there might be an alternative. So I think, you know, do a little bit of research, but don't go too far down that rabbit hole before talking to someone about it. I think the starting point could be with a surgeon, particularly if it's a surgeon that, you know, you've had recommendations for and you trust. But to go in saying, look, I'm not ready to make any bookings for this, I'm not ready to commit to having this done, but I just want to sort of discuss it and see if it's right for me and ask some questions. And then I think it can be really helpful to have an external person who's, you know, doesn't gain anything, they're not getting paid for doing the surgery. I think it can be helpful to have a chat with them, and that might be a psychologist. It could even just be a trusted friend or family member. And talk through the motivations for the procedure. You know, why are you thinking about this? How long have you been thinking about it for? What some of your expectations are, and what you're hoping will change afterwards. And so certainly, you know, when I do these assessments, like if you speak to a psychologist who has experience in this area, they can really help to explore whether those expectations are realistic. You know, maybe it's that you're hoping you're going to find a new partner after getting this surgery, and that might not be the most realistic expectation. You can have someone who knows a bit about the area to help guide you and help develop more realistic goals before going ahead and starting that journey. So yeah, I think psychologists are a great resource. I think sometimes people feel nervous because they're like, well, I don't have a mental illness, I don't need to go see a psychologist.
Yeah.
But we can obviously do a lot more than just deal
Yeah,
with
of
mental
course.
illness. So
Yeah.
I think it can be helpful for that as well.
Yeah, I think it should be part of everybody's mental health plan that you just need. It's good to have someone to talk to that's got no skin in the game, that's, even for advice and stuff like that, just because that they're not part of your family, they're not part of your friend group, they're just someone that you can actually speak to and get, so I'm into psychology.
Yeah.
I'm into, I've had many times in my life where I've needed to go and see someone just to get that, neutral, advice from as well. So
That's
yeah,
exactly it. That neutrality, because I don't have anything to, gain or lose whether or not the patient gets a surgery. It doesn't make any difference to me. I'm not going to get money for it. And so it can really help to explore it in that safe environment. Whereas family and friends might be saying, no, you absolutely don't need that. Or you have people saying, yes, go and get it.
Of
And again,
course.
a surgeon or injector also has a bit of an interest there. And so having that neutral perspective can be really helpful.
Yeah, no, that's true. And so, say for example, is your service available online? Like, because I don't know about, I live in the Northern Rivers, so I live around the Byron Bay area. So to get in somewhere is freaking impossible. Like, you can't get in like forever. Like, it's just, and that's with everything, really.
Yeah.
So how, like, how accessible is a service like that?
Yeah, so my goal has been to make it as accessible as possible, particularly with all of these new guidelines that came in. I think lots of people were really concerned, or there's going to be lots of people who need to see a psychologist for an assessment for surgery or want to see them, and no one's going to be able to get in anywhere. So we have a team of five psychologists at the moment who do it all via telehealth. And so Australia-wide, rural, city-based, and we can see people within a couple of weeks. So it can be really quick to get in, at least for that initial discussion and the initial assessment. Sometimes that's all that people need. It's just that 1 hour chat to sort of have a discussion about the motivations and get a clearer head about what you're thinking.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes people might want a bit more support. And so if it is that ongoing support, there might be a little bit of a longer wait sometimes to get that, but usually that initial appointment can happen really quickly.
Yeah, right. And just one last question. So, what do you think of those guidelines? Do you think because like they're there for, they say they're there for patient safety, and it's really funny because I started my blog for that very reason, for patient safety, because I'd had an experience that might it wasn't a bad experience, but afterwards was a bad experience. My recovery was not well, and that's when I tried to reach out to people to sort of say what's going on, and that's how I kind of even got in this industry. So what do you think of the guidelines? Because I, yeah.
Yeah, I personally, I think the screening guidelines in particular, I think are really helpful. I think there
You're
are some
talking for
issues.
surgical? For surgical?
Yeah, for surgical and non-surgical. I think for non-surgical procedures, even with, fillet with injectables, people see it as, okay, it's really minor, it's not a big deal. Like, why do I need to go through this lengthy process? But when you start getting injectables, you're potentially committing to doing those for the next 30, 40 years if you want
Forever.
get the
Yeah,
results forever.
exactly.
Exactly. So it's still a big decision, even though one treatment is not necessarily a big decision, the long-term journey you're committing to is. And so I think it's really helpful for both. And again, it's about just equipping people with more knowledge and helping them make informed choices and really, providing extra support if support is needed. And so I think overall it's a good thing. I think there'll be teething problems, and there have been teething problems already, I'm sure. And it'll just take some time before it's a normal process. But yeah, overall, I think it can be really helpful for patients and for practitioners as well.
So does that mean if I'm a new patient and I go into a clinic, do I have to have a, is there a screening questionnaire or something that is compulsory for me to have to complete now before? Okay. Which
Yes.
means that if someone wasn't doing that, you'd want to be aware of getting that jab. That very first jab. So it's legal. It's illegal now not to do that. Is that right?
Exactly. So, yeah, the guidelines are a little bit stricter for surgery compared to non-surgical. So, with surgery, they have to be using a validated screening tool. So that they certainly, if you're going in for a surgical consult and there's no discussion, no questionnaire about your psychological well-being, that might be a bit of a red flag. And now for injectables, I think there's more guidelines probably to come in the next couple of months. I think it will probably be the same. And so that's definitely something to look out for.
Well, it's funny because on that, I've had a gastric sleeve, and before I had that, the client, there was a psychologist there that you had to actually see before they even took you that next step. So, we're probably going to be seeing more of that sort of thing, like nutritionists, psychologists, you know, more well-being people involved in the clinics, because it's all, although there's aesthetics, you know, surgery and cosmetics, it's kind of all combined with wellness and nutrition. It's all one whole thing. So we might be seeing more of, you know, combination groups, for want of a better word, which would be really good as well.
Of course. With bariatric surgery, that's been the process for many years already, that psychologists are quite embedded in that process. Still relatively new in the cosmetic surgery space. But I think, patients can only benefit from that, from having more professionals involved in their care and more holistic treatments and more support from all angles to get better outcomes.
Well, that might just happen. You never know.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Well, before we go, I've got to say thank you so much for your time, because I know you've got a little baby and I know how hard that is, because I'm a grandmother of a few, so I know what the mums and dads go through. So thank you for taking the time. We've tried to book this in for ages, hey?
No, it's actually so lovely. It's been a pleasure to be able to talk about something else rather than like nappies and baby poo for half an hour.
Totally.
So I really enjoyed it.
And just before you go, I'll just mention, so the website where for your business is readymind.com.au. People can just go on there and have a look, have a read around, because I've been reading it this morning and it's worth just reading it anyway.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's a good resource for patients themselves. So if they're interested in booking in, you know, a chat with a psychologist before getting a surgery or procedure, you can definitely do that through the website. Good practitioners as well, if they're interested in, you know, how to screen their patients, what sort of screening questionnaires are available, and who to refer them on to for further support. There's also some great information about that on the website.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Trish. So lovely to talk to you again.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Got a burning question for Trish? Message her on Instagram at Transforming Bodies, or join the 12,000 plus people in the Facebook group Plastic Surgery Support Forum for Aussie Chicks.